it's not the great things that we try to accomplish that are really important. I mean, sure, they're important, but the small things that we do day to day that we can easily do, there's no reason to be discouraged because those things add up. It takes time, but if we trust God, it'll happen. Hello, and thanks for listening. I'm Jason Sparks. This is Sparking Spiritual Growth. Thanks for tuning in on the Gospel Radio Network. I've said it myself many times. I wish I had more self-control. And I didn't really understand self-control. I've started learning over the years, but I just thought it meant just, you know, the ability to say no. And I think that's most of us how we see it. There's a whole lot more to it than that. It's a lot more complicated and complex than just that. That's a starting place, and that's kind of the reason that I thought it was that definition was because that's what I'd been taught. You know, going to Sunday school, self-control, say no to the things that you should say no to. And there's a world of temptation out there that we have to learn to say no to. But I've also learned over time that it's not just enough to say no. Jesus actually told a parable of a spirit that was in a house, and a man came in and cleaned up the house and got rid of the evil spirit and tidied up everything. Evidently, the evil spirit had done all kinds of things inside it, and then left it alone, and the spirit wandered around for a while and couldn't find any place to rest, so came back to that house and brought with him seven other spirits and entered in, and it was worse than the beginning. That was, I guess, a parable to explain to them the state of the Jewish leadership at the time, and a lesson that you can't just clean up your life, clean out all the bad stuff, and be done with it because you're going to get worse. And that's true. And we tend to do that. We tend to clean up our act. You know, we're gonna get rid of all the bad stuff in life, and then we're going to be good people. It doesn't work that way by itself. If we just get rid of the bad stuff and we don't replace it with something that's good, we're really not going to get very far. And we're going to probably end up worse than we were, at least going back to what we were before. And it's just a matter of time. And the reason for that is because you really haven't made any changes. You've only denied yourself things, right? The reason that we pursue a lot of things in life, especially things that are bad for us, really anything, it's because we have some kind of need that we're filling with those things, or we wouldn't pursue them. Some people pursue things that they know are bad for them, but they also feel like they have to have them. They're filling a need that nothing else can fill. And that's a sad situation. But what Jesus taught us is that we can fill our lives with God and with good things, and that will replace the things that are bad, the things that we think we have to do in order to survive and live. Those are not necessarily what we should do to survive and live. If we look in the eternal principles, we're going to be able to see that. And that's what the basis of self-control is, that we're saying yes to the right things, and we have to know what the right things are. So saying yes to the right things, there's a certain pathway that we have to go through, and the Bible teaches us this in many different ways. And these are ideas and principles that are found in what Paul calls the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5, verses 22 and 23. And in putting these together and reasoning through and seeing how other people have done it, how I've done things in my life, I've kind of arranged them in a certain way that makes sense to me to help create a path toward self-control. And it starts with meekness. Meekness is a word that means basically acceptance. Not resignation, like I'm resigning to my fate, but it's an acceptance, an embracing of who we are, of embracing our roles. And so an important part of the process of growth is to recognize what we're supposed to be doing, recognize what our roles are. And we all have roles, and we were made to be certain things in certain situations, and we have roles and responsibilities toward all the people in our lives to some degree or another. We are responsible for our interactions with other people, and so we have roles. If we learn to accept those early in life, then our life goes a little smoother, but if we want to rebel against those things, then we might can create our own pathway, but we're still going to create some roles, and Sometimes those roles end up being much worse than if we had just listened in the first place. But that's the beginning of creating self-control. Then you move into kindness, and kindness is looking at people the way God does and seeing them actually also in relationship to your role toward them. So, for example, I can show kindness to my wife in ways that no one else can. And that's how I should be showing kindness to my wife. Not necessarily in all the ways that everyone else can, but the ways that I can do it that no one else can, those should be the emphasis for me. And same thing with her for me, same thing with you with your children, same thing with you with family or friends or even your employers, your employees. There are ways that you can interact with people that is a little bit unique that other people can, but they don't necessarily have the ability to interact with them in the way that you do. That's understanding that is kindness. You're showing kindness in the way that God wants you to do it. And, you know, of course it relates to good, better, and best. It relates to what's best for the situation based on who you are and the way God sees your relationship with them and the way God sees them. All those things have to be taken into account. And then moving from kindness, we go to goodness. And goodness is just doing that one thing. That is, we find out who we are, what we're supposed to be doing with our lives, and doing it. I mean, that's really what goodness is about. There's two sides to this coin. One side is morality, that it's good, morally good. And the other side is it's useful. It's good as in it's useful to other people. And so with those two combined, we start doing good things. And it relates to our kindness. It relates to our meekness of who we are. All these things relate to one another. And then from that, we have faithfulness. And faithfulness is really nothing more than conviction. Well, there's more to it than conviction. But at its heart, the basis of faithfulness is conviction. A conviction, a firm belief that I am going to accomplish these good things. This good thing, my life will be worth something. I'm going to make it happen. And of course, you're not doing it all by yourself. You're doing it with God. But you have to have a conviction in your life and live it into your life. Make it part of who you are. And then from there, we get self-control. Because self-control is it's taking all the parts of life that we have and focusing them into that one good thing. Making your marriage, you know, not doing good in your marriage, but making your marriage contribute to the good that you're doing for reality. It's a part of who you are. And self-control really is the focus of all those different parts of life. Your faith, your family, your finances, your health, your career, your recreation, and even your friendships. All these need to be pointing in the same direction. They're focused. It's like a laser. Different lasers coming into one spot. And you're going to have a lot of power that way in life. That's the secret to having self-control. It's not a secret as in, you know, I just have to flip this certain switch in my head and all of a sudden I have self-control. That's not how self-control works. Self-control is when you have the conviction to do what is right and you're focusing all the parts of your life together in the same direction. You have a unified mind, unified focus. And when you have that, you have a great amount of power over yourself. You're still going to make mistakes. You're still going to do boneheaded things now and then. That's life. But at least you're going to be able to have some kind of control over what you're doing. And self-control is not as much as control itself of the self. It is more of managing self. It's giving ourselves permission to succeed. It's giving ourselves the ability to succeed and, you know, providing those things and opportunities so that we can actually succeed. We can do those things. And the only way you can do that is if you're focused, because you see opportunities then. We can kind of meander through life and we can just allow things to happen as they happen, but that's really no way to live, because the only guarantee you have with that is pain. That's the only guarantee that you have if you live that kind of life. But if you will live the life that God wants you to live and you're focused on accomplishing who you are and being who God wants you to be, you're going to have guaranteed success, because God wants you to grow. And if you're doing things the way God wants you to do them, he's going to help you grow. And that's something you can read John chapter 15, verses 1 through 8. It talks about that. Jesus goes into great detail about the importance of it. And also, in it's a parable, but it helps us to understand why God has a vested interest in our success. He set it up in such a way that when we succeed, he gets glory and honor. And so the more we succeed, the more fruit we develop, the more glory he receives. And that being the case, he's going to prune us and help us and make sure we have everything that we need in order to succeed as much as possible. But we have to make that decision to be the person that God wants us to be. So we go through this process, and then we have self-control. And there's more to the fruit of the Spirit. There's 9 pieces of that. And we've only talked about the first 5. But that is a very important part of the process. Having self-control can only come when we have the faithfulness that comes from the goodness, that comes from the kindness, that comes from the meekness. And that's where it all starts. If you need help with that, I want to help you. Please reach out to me. You can email me, jason@sparksmore.com. And I'll be glad to help you, interact with you. We can get on the phone and have a complimentary phone call. That would be perfectly fine with me. What we need to do is help you find the right path, get on that path, and make sure that you have the proper motivation and help to continue on with it. But there are hindrances then to this pathway of self-control. There are several things, and I started making a list, and it was a long list, so I thought, I'll just take the top 5. Here are the top 5 things that hinder our self-control. Some of them may actually be a surprise. The first one is the neglect of the spiritual life. Focusing on the wrong thing is a hidden danger, and it's something you don't want to find out too late. But it can happen if we're not careful. It's dangerous because these principles are eternal principles. They'll work in many other situations. So if you will focus, if you'll accept a role for your life, it doesn't have to be God's role. Now, understand what I'm saying here. This will work even if you don't believe in God. This is the process. This is how life works. So you can have meekness, you can have finally accept some kind of role for your life, and you can look at that role and decide how you're going to treat other people based on that role, and then you can determine this one good thing, and it doesn't even have to be morally good if you don't believe in God. You just figure out something that you can do that hurts the least amount of people possible, and then you really get a conviction about it and focus your whole all of life on that particular process, and you can have great success. But what good does it do for you to go through all that problems and all that pain to have something that's going to fade away and be useless? I mean, sure, for the present, it might be okay. It might feel good and it might feel very fulfilling. But what do you have in the end? In the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon, he was king. He was a great wealthy man, extremely rich and extremely wise. But that wisdom was kind of an earthly wisdom. He knew how to make money. Basically, that's what it came down to. He knew how to make money. He knew how to run his kingdom in such a way that he had peace and prosperity. And not knocking that, it's a great thing. But he kind of set his mind to trying to figure out what life is about, because in all the living that he did, he soaked up everything he could, and he realized it's all worthless. It's all like chasing the wind, because it's all going to fade away. Even the great new things that he thought he was accomplishing in life, he realized that other people had already done it. You're not really doing anything new. And we have some modern advances and things like this. But for the most part, if you think about it, life is going to end and we will go back to the dust and it'll be over and people will mourn for us for a few days, maybe a few weeks, and they'll forget about us very quickly. And when they do remember us, it's going to be, maybe you'll be great enough that you actually have a holiday in your honor. So they'll go out and party and drink on the memorial of your death. Really, what is it of value? And that's what Solomon really came to the conclusion. He tried everything in the world, but nothing really made sense or nothing really was fulfilling until he considered the spiritual. And he was actually forced to that conclusion by the prospect of death. And he realized the most important thing you can do is to love God and to serve him. That's the only thing that actually brings any meaning to life. So one of the greatest hindrances to a true self-control is a false self-control. That is, you are controlling yourself, but you're going the wrong direction. The second one would be discouragement. And, oh, this is a big one. And this is really, it sucks the power out of your life. And it's so easy to get discouraged. And sometimes it becomes a habit. Sometimes it becomes a little bit of a crutch. Be honest, we would rather be discouraged because then we don't have to worry about doing anything, or we get a kind of a loser's limp. Zig Ziglar, I don't know if he actually, you know, phrased that the first time, but he talked about a loser's limp, and we've all done it, or we've all seen it at least. You ever been in a race? I've done this, and your pride is kind of on the line. So you're running really hard in a race and you're a kid, and the guy is the person that you're racing against is just beating you hands down. There's nothing you can do about it. And all of a sudden you kind of quote unquote twist your ankle. You didn't really do it, but you kind of limp around like you did. You give yourself an inborn excuse of why you didn't accomplish and why you didn't win. So you could save face. And, oh, yeah, he beat me, but I tripped and I hurt myself. And so it doesn't really count, right? And then you never race the guy again. That's called a loser's limp. And that's what sometimes discouragement can become. We kind of get used to realizing that, oh, you know, if I can be discouraged, and I can use that actually to blame why I don't accomplish things. And then people can look at me and say, oh, he tried, but he was just discouraged. Now, look, I'm not saying that discouragement isn't a legitimate problem. It is. But I'm saying it can become habitual. And that definitely is going to work against your self-control. It could be something that it becomes a pattern for us, and maybe even a tool that we use. So let's get rid of that as much as possible. And, you know, because discouragement, even, you know, one-time situation of discouragement can suck the power out of your life. It's just, it can destroy you. And it can make you do things you never thought you would do and avoid doing things that you always thought you loved to do. Discouragement can easily go into depression and things like that. But power is the ability to get things done. And if discouragement takes that power away from you, then you're in trouble. I think this is one of Satan's most powerful tools that he has tried to discourage people. And, you know, what good is knowing what your life should become if you're not encouraged to actually make it happen? You just, oh, you know, that's a recipe for regret. That's a recipe for sitting on your deathbed, laying on your deathbed one day, looking back and thinking, oh, man, if only I would have done this. Don't do that. Don't put yourself in that position. I assume, you know, I'm going to have regrets. I have regrets now, but I want to try to minimize those. I don't want to make them worse. So how do we overcome this discouragement? Elijah was one who faced discouragement, and at least in this one particular spot, there was an incident where Elijah called for all the prophets of Baal. It was an amazing situation, amazing victory for the prophet of God. And he called for them to I think there were 450 prophets or something like that. It was a large number. I haven't read it in a few days, so I can't remember the number. But when he called for them, he puts out this challenge. Let's see who God really is. If he's your God, we'll follow him. If he's my God, we'll follow him. And they agreed to this. And so the prophets of Baal made an altar, and they put a sacrifice on it. And they didn't light it. They called for Baal to actually strike fire to it and light it and burn it himself. And that was the conditions. And so they did that. They cut themselves. They danced around. They played music. They did it for a whole half of a day. And for hours they did this until they were worn out. And Elijah just made fun of them and just said, you know, where's your God? You know, maybe he's relieving himself. I mean, that's one of the things he said. He was poking fun at them. And then he said, all right, let me have this chance. And so he made an altar, and he put a sacrifice on it. He dug a trench around it, and he filled it, poured water over the altar, poured so much water over the altar that it filled up the trench. And then he said one prayer, and God struck it with lightning and burned up everything, including the water that was in the trench around it, just completely gone. And that's a great victory that he had. And then he had all the prophets killed, prophets of Baal killed, because of their false ways and their treachery of trying to get Israel to sin. And then he finds out that the queen is out to kill him because of this, because she was a worshiper of Baal. And he runs for his life, and he is so discouraged. He just says, just kill me now. There's nothing left for me to live for. He went from something that was a great victory to down in the depths and had no motivation, nothing. He just wanted to die. If you read through that, you see what God did and how he interacted with him and basically encouraged him and put him to work. And he did it by showing Elijah who God is, showing Elijah where God lives and reigns, and that is, he lives in the quiet parts. It's not the great victories that really make life worthwhile. It's the small things, the day-to-day things that really add up to a great life. And so this was a lesson that he had to learn. And when we do that, when we go through similar things, then we need to also recognize that it's not the great things that we try to accomplish that are really important. I mean, sure, they're important, but the small things that we do day-to-day that we can easily do, there's no reason to be discouraged because those things add up. It takes time, but if we trust God, it'll happen. And also making sure we refocus ourselves. When we refocus, that helps discouragement quite a bit. The third one is divided focus. And I've talked a lot about the focus that we need. Self-control is all about focus. If you're not focused, you can't accomplish what you should or even what you could do. And that's a big problem in Christianity because seeing the eternal is very difficult, but seeing the shiny that is all around us, it's really easy. And so we get tripped up sometimes. We have a divided focus. And Jesus talked about this in Matthew 6, 22 through 24. 22 and 23 says, "The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" So think about what he's saying. Your eye, if the lamp of the body is the eye. And the eye represents things that you're searching for, what you're looking for. And if you're looking for, if what you're doing is looking for, if you're looking for the right things, if your eye is good, and really the idea of a good eye means that they're both working in the same direction. You're looking at the same, both eyes are focused on the same thing. A bad eye would be one, you have a wonky eye. You're looking one way with one and one way the other. That's his point. Because the next verse, in verse 24, he says, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he'll be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." And his point is, if you have a good eye, that is, you have good vision, you're seeing clearly, that's because you're focused on one thing. But if you try to focus on two things at once, you can't do it. There's no possible way that you can focus on two things at once. We think that we can, but we can't. And so focus, your focus is very important. You've got to make a decision. Am I going to focus on the eternal or the physical? There is no doing both. Now, we can jump back and forth from both, sure, but that's certainly no way to live either because that's just going to stop all momentum and growth. So that's what how we can fix a divided focus. Focus in the right direction. Number four, this is the fourth way that we hinder self-control, and that is lacking the humility necessary to accept who you are. We kind of get into the thinking of we're more than we are, or maybe we think that we're less than we are, and for whatever reason, we don't accept the fact of who we are. We don't accept our circumstances. We don't accept our opportunities, and so we never live into our role. We never embrace our role of who we are. You can't have self-control if you don't actually live the life that you're supposed to live. That's what self-control really is all about. That's the reason you have self-control, is to live that life that you're supposed to be living. Moses is an example of that. When he first was called to be a leader, to go and lead the people out of Israel, the Israelites out of Egypt, he didn't want to do it. He wouldn't accept it. And he gave all kinds of excuses and reasons for it. And he needed to realize that leadership is a service to other people. And humility is accepting that opportunity and embracing it. How can you help other people if you refuse to serve them? He didn't want to live into that. Sometimes we have opportunities to do good and we just don't because we just don't want to be that person. We don't want to be the kind of person that does this or that. And that's not a good place because you are who you are. God made you to be who he made you to be. And he's given you opportunities that we should not squander. He's given us skills and abilities and all kinds of things that we should never squander. We should use them to the best of our ability to serve God. And the fifth one, this is a hindrance to your self-control, is not being clear on your purpose. And that's a big one too, not understanding what you're supposed to do with your life. If you're not even really sure what your focus is, then how are you going to live it out? Now, generally speaking, what Jesus was talking about focusing on, we do have a focus. As Christians, we love the Lord our God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. With Christians, we live to glorify God. That's why we're here. But it's not enough to just say that. He was talking to a lot of people, but each of us individually have also additional opportunities that relate to those things. So I love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength by doing something. What is it that I do? That's based on my skills, based on my abilities, it's based on my opportunities, my talents. Read the parable of the talents, and that's exactly what is being explained there. Use the opportunities that you have to do good. But if you're not actually clear on what you can or can't do, then how are you going to do it? And I think that's probably one of the biggest hindrances to self-control that there is, because you can't be focused. You can't have all the parts of your life focused in one direction if you don't know what that one direction is, right? And the more specific we get, the better off we are. Sometimes as Christians, we do ourselves a disfavor by accepting just at face value the idea that we should, that our purpose is to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. Yes, no question that is what we said that we should do. I've already talked about that. We do ourselves a disservice by thinking that we don't have to think about that anymore. We do that disservice because we don't realize that that requires us to make some decisions. It requires us to figure out what we're going to do and to say no to the wrong things and say yes to the right things. And there are a million good things that you can do, but you can't do a million good things in a day. In a given day, you might find a million opportunities, but you can't do them all. So what are you going to do? The only way you're going to know which ones to do is to figure out who you are and what your purpose is. Then you know. It becomes very obvious what you should do. That doesn't mean it's always going to be easy to make the decision, but at least you have some grounds to work with rather than kind of flying by the seat of your pants kind of idea of, well, I'll just see what happens and, you know, maybe someone will ask me and I'll be able to be invited to do this or that. And if that's the case, then you may be waiting a long time and you may be squandering a lot of opportunities that where God is saying, hey, would you want to be a part of this? And you just don't recognize the invitation. Sometimes things are presented to us on a silver platter and we look at it and go, yeah, I think I'll wait. A good example, there was a story of, this is actually a joke, and I don't think it's very funny, but it's a joke. A man was in a flood and his house was being flooded. And so he climbed up on the roof and a boat came by. And he said, no, thanks, God's going to save me. And so another boat came by and they said, get in the boat. And the water kept rising. He said, no, God will save me. Don't worry about it. And then there was just water everywhere. He was very, on the very top of his house. And there was just water very close to him. And he was in bad, bad situation. And a helicopter came. And he said, no, I don't want to get on because God will take care of me. He'll save me. And so the man died and he went up to see God. And he said, God, where were you? I thought you would save me. And he said, I sent you two boats and a helicopter. He was waiting for a personal invitation, I guess. What are you waiting for? Why is it that you look at your life and see all the opportunities to do good and you wait to do it? It might be that you have some of these hindrances, maybe some more. If you want to talk about this, get with me. I'd love to talk to you about this. Email me, Jason@sparksmore.com. And let's get things going.